Hey, everybody, welcome to the Daniel Davis Deep Dive Intelligence Brief, where we bring you the best of what we learned this week and the most important things that happened overnight. All kinds of things are going on right now. President Trump was supposed to be going to his son's wedding. He was supposed to be going to Florida. And then dramatic scenes where the motorcade is seen rushing back to the Capitol, into the White House. And everybody's like, man, the war's going to start tonight. And then it's like, no, actually, it's not going to start. But there's still negotiations. President Trump wants to give more time for negotiations. And then there's this flurry of activity in the Middle East. All of this stuff going on just in the last few hours. Now, forget about the last 24 hours or overnight. Things are happening even this morning as we're getting ready for the show here. So let me try to bring you up to date on where we are. Bottom line is, I think that a lot of claims and talks about negotiations are going on, but I don't believe any of it. I think a lot of people are talking, let me be clear, but I don't think that there's any actual negotiations going on. I think that people are talking past one another, left and right, and trying to hope against hope that the other side does what they want, but not actually any kind of negotiations. And to be clear, a negotiation means that you give something to get something. Both sides have to be willing to do that, not one side, both sides. And if both sides aren't, then there are no negotiations. And right now, it looks like that really neither side is willing to give very much. We're going to see some of the details of that as we go on. First of all, let's take a look at something President Trump said, which he's going to be talking kind of about Iran here, also in the context of Venezuela. But underneath, I want you to pay attention to the subtext here, because you're going to see this theme, unfortunately, running throughout this entire show here. You can't get negotiations unless you have some level of trust that the other side will do whatever it agrees to. You don't have to like them at all. That doesn't even have to be part of the equation. You can hate each other, but you have to have some minimal level of trust that each side will do whatever it agrees to. Just consider even the Versailles Treaty that ended World War I. Believe me, there was tremendous amounts of animosity and hatred between the parties there, but at least they got together to make a deal. Of course, it was a bad deal and laid the foundation 25 years later for World War II. But the point being that at least among even people that don't like each other, to end that war, they at least had some level of trust that they would do what they said. And for a fair period of time, they actually did. Until you get to that point, you're not going to actually have any negotiations. And then you're going to have what's left, which is the likelihood that this ends up back into war. That's the bottom line here at the stop. But in the issue of trust, one of the reasons why the Iranian side doesn't trust us is we've talked about so many times about all the things that we've said, negotiations that were happening, and then we attack and all that. But even just on basic things, basic elementary truths, there's no truth behind them. And if you see you can't tell the truth on anything, then why will people believe a word that comes out of your mouth on any topic? Case in point. President Trump just last night was addressing a crowd and bragging about how, by the way, all this stuff you've heard about how much we're spending on this war. Turns out we have an extra bank account that somebody else is paying the bill.
Hey, by the way, how did we do in Venezuela? Not bad. That's why is it? You know, we've taken out so much oil in Venezuela. We paid for the cost of the war about 25 times over. When did you hear that last? You know, it's a one-way street.
Yeah, it's a one-way street. Now, just on the surface of it, who's going to want to listen to that? That you went into this country and stole their oil, and then you want to have negotiations with another country and think that they're going to believe you? But even more important than that, we have seen that there was about a $200 billion congressional bill that they wanted to pass to pay for all this war so far. $200 billion is what he said. I think that the average is about had been up the first few portions of the war over $1 billion a day. I think $29 billion was what I heard, what it had physically cost up to that point. Of course, the clock is always ticking because of all these forces deployed. So you pick it, either $29 billion or $200 billion that we were asking Congress for, et cetera. But when you look at our energy chief, Wright. He said this is back in February. Up to that point, he said he testified that the U.S. had gotten $1 billion from Venezuelan oil, and that he hoped to get $5 billion in the coming 3 months. So that was in February, March, April, May. So that would be around now. So if everything he said turned out to be true, and it usually isn't, but let's just give him the benefit of the doubt. That would be $6 billion, not 29, not 200, six. And that would imply that we are literally taking every dollar from the sale of Venezuelan oil and keeping it, and then applying it into the national treasury to pay off this war here. There's no evidence that that's happening either. In fact, what we've claimed is that we're in a cooperative deal and they get some proportion out of the gracious and the goodness of our heart. We allow them to keep some money from their own resource that we're otherwise stealing. I don't know how the numbers are working out. He hasn't provided any. But even what we do know, there is no truth to what he says. So all the people in that room you saw, all the people in his audience were clapping and cheering. It was great. It was wonderful. We believe every word you say, but they don't matter. What they believe doesn't matter in terms of the war. Now, he will lie to them left and right because the real target of President Trump's primary deception has always been his followers. The people who trust him the most are the ones being most deceived and undercut. That's just one of the cruel truths that will one day be manifest and will one day come to manifestation. He will pay for that because once his core supporters realize that they have been deceived all along and that they were being played fools by him, the person to whom they gave all of this support, that will be an ugly day for President Trump, because when it falls, it'll be like a cliff. They'll just fall off the edge and it'll never be recovered. We're not there yet, though. That's still on. Well, another odd one is from Marco Rubio. And I'm not sure if this was last night or today either, but he was making some comments here. And listen to this at first. He's going to be talking here about something that we have to start doing.
We have to start thinking about what do we do if a few weeks from now Iran decides we don't care. We're going to keep the straits closed. We're going to sink any ship that doesn't listen to us or doesn't pay us. Then someone's going to have to do something about it. Okay, they're not just going to voluntarily reopen the straits. Happening. I know there's a plan in place for what to do if the shooting stops, but we have to have a plan B for if someone is shooting. You know, how do you reopen the straits?
What are you talking about? What is today? This is May 23rd. This war started on the 28th of February. And today you want to start thinking about what happens if we can't open the Strait of Hormuz? I mean, what is anybody supposed to make out of that? When you have one of the top three positions in these two videos, you have the number one and at least the number three, possibly number two position in the United States of America, Secretary of State, President of the United States. And he is saying, we got to figure out a plan B. How can you possibly not have a plan B, C, and D at this point? You should have had at least a plan A, B, and C before the thing started, before you launched one missile, before you sent one ship into combat, before you launched one plane. You should have said, all right, here's how we hope this goes. But if it goes sideways, then here's the two or three things we'll do after that. If it goes great, if it goes better than expected, well, here's some alternatives we can do. Here's some things we can do to rapidly accelerate so we have resources. So if it goes really good, I need to have resources in place to be able to exploit that. If it goes sideways, I need to have resources to mitigate these damages, and we have to have a plan. All of that happens before one missile is fired, or it should if you have just the least amount of common sense and maturity. And one has to wonder, do we have that at any level in this government? And then here in the fourth month, the third or fourth month of this war, you have the Secretary of State saying, we've got to figure something out. And if they keep doing what they're doing, which they've been doing since day one, we got to have a plan B. So you're trying to figure out a plan B as you're trying to allegedly negotiate an end to this war. Now, there's been a lot of talks about some things on Saturday. I think it was Friday into Saturday. No, I'm sorry, a Thursday night into Friday, and then that led into Saturday here. A lot of talk on the Western media, especially in X and several other social media platforms, that we were nearly there. We nearly had a deal. Everything was close. We're just trying to finalize things. Maybe it's going to be an end-of-war negotiation, and then that's going to set the stage for 30 days of debate, discussion over all the details, but it's going to be a full end of war, et cetera. There was no truth to that either. That was all a lie. That's like the seventh or eighth, maybe even the tenth time something like that has happened. I'll tell you for sure what that was, but based on evidence, that was another attempt to manipulate markets, to make on a Friday, to make the stock market go up and the price of oil go down. And both of those things happened. So somebody, according to reports that I've seen, again, made a lot of money. There was no truth to any of it. So again, somebody with direct connections to President Trump himself, because they know when he's going to make announcements and they know when leaks are going to be given to all the usual suspects here, CBS News, Axios, several Bloomberg, a number of Fox News, of course, all of these are given all this information. They keep publishing it out and it has the expected results on the markets. They either go up or down, depending on which one we're talking about. And somebody already knows what's coming in a place contracts so that they benefit from whichever way the market goes ahead of time. But in fact, there was no negotiations. Look, you can't have an end-to-war negotiation by just sending notes back and forth through intermediaries. All of those things, which are going on, by the way, there are communications through intermediaries between the U.S. and Iran. But all of those things happen to set up the actual negotiations. You have to get to some level of where, all right, we're at least in the same zip code. Now then, let's meet together. You cannot get to an end of war negotiation unless you have the principal sitting right there, like the Secretary of State or vice presidential level. Somebody at that level. We haven't even done that yet. So no one should believe any of that. But that's just the world we live in right now, where people are able to make billions of dollars, individuals who have hundreds of millions to put on these contracts, and then they're reaping in the billions. People claim that, oh, we're investigating this and that, but nothing ever happens, and the trades keep going on. Because I've said this before, and this is just another example, we're basically a country that's no longer governed by the rule of law. And so whether it's international law, whether it's the Constitution or financial law like this, no one cares, because all the instruments of power are in the hands of the guy and his very closest friends who benefit from it. They're not going to investigate themselves. So that's what we have. Now, that's stuff domestically we've got to worry about. But how does that affect what's going on internationally? Let me just show you a couple of things here just from last night and this morning here. You have a field marshal from Pakistan, Azmir Munir, met with Araghchi, the foreign minister from Iran, yesterday. This meeting continued until late into the night. The two sides exchanged views on the latest diplomatic efforts and initiatives to prevent the escalation of tensions and end the war imposed by the United States and Israel in Iran. And then this morning, we had another, Iran's chief negotiator, Ghalibaf, has met with the Pakistani army chief, Munir, again, according to state media. So they're putting this out. So they're talking quite a bit there. After this conversation, you had Ghalibaf, and this is just, when was this? 7:28. So that was just a little over an hour and a half ago since when we're making the show here. Ghalibaf warns Trump, we will not compromise on the rights of our nation and country, especially with a party that has no honesty at all and cannot be trusted. There's that word again. Our armed forces have rebuilt themselves during the ceasefire. If Trump foolishly restarts the war, they will definitely be more crushing and bitter for the United States than on the first day of the war. Now, there have been other reports here in the last couple of days to where the Iranian side has said, listen, we're not only going to go back to what we did before. And we've now seen validated by Western media that the missiles and drones fired by the Iranian side were in many cases pinpoint accurate. However many were actually intercepted and knocked down is a subject of debate. But what is not subject of debate is that whatever that percentage is that got through was on target and at the critical target. So we already know that they can hit stuff that they shoot at, and it can be really harsh in its results for us, costly for us. Now they're saying that if we go back to it, they're going to expand the target list, not just in the GCC, but they say expand it beyond the Middle East. And it's up to anybody's interpretation of what that means, because they weren't very specific on it. They intentionally weren't specific. So they're saying, listen, we're going to hit other countries. We're going to hit other targets in the same countries. And they've had a lot of time to come up with a new target list, and things that they didn't attack the first time, they could hit the second thing. See, our problem is that if we want to go back and restart the war, that there's only one set of targets that we need to go after that we didn't get the first time. Those are buried in a mountain. So when we had the best of our long-range missiles, especially the ATACMs, the JASMs, and the Tomahawk cruise missiles, and some of these bunker busters too, they had limited effect on some of these underground missile cities. Most had no effect at all. Just hitting granite mountainsides, rattling the rafters, knocking some dust off some of the light fixtures inside, no doubt. But that's it. If we return, all we can do is fire the same munitions against the same target, and we'll have the same outcome. So we don't have anywhere to ratchet up to, unless President Trump is thinking about using nuclear weapons, and that's a whole other conversation that we'll have. Even that, though, would not destroy Iran, because these underground bunkers are designed to survive nuclear blasts. So it's that, too. But the other side, Iran does have lots of room to expand their target list and can even bring profoundly more pain to us. There's also the issues of these underwater internet cables that are running under the Strait of Hormuz, which just devastate global economy, especially in that region. It would just be absolutely devastating, and it would take years probably to recover and to repair all that stuff. They're saying all that's at risk too if attacked. So they have a lot more military cards they could play if we go back to war. We can only play the same hand that didn't work the first time, folks. It would be absurd to the highest degree to go back and try to do what didn't work the first time. It is a hardcore issue. The mountains can't be penetrated with our weapons, and that's where they have their long-range missiles and their drone factories. Everything that they need to continue to execute on all these things are going on here. And of course, our blockade is causing significant damage inside of Iran. It's causing significant hardship on their population. Unemployment is going through the roof. Their currency has been devalued because of our efforts out there. So they are definitely suffering. And it's not minor, and it's not insignificant. But it's something that they can survive, and they can endure for a long time. And they are calculating that they can endure that longer than we can. Because all of our issues, while President Trump's statements and others leaked information did drive the price of oil down, the strategic petroleum reserves and all these other storage tanks are getting close to running dry, or they don't have it. And then there will be a physical shortage of supply, and you just can't do economic activity if you don't physically have the oil. And we're getting close to that. And I think the Iranian side is calculating, hey, dude, you want to go down that path? You want to play chicken? We can play it because we can suffer more than you do. Now, there is some information out here on DropSite News this morning that talks about what the Iranian side are willing to talk about, because they are willing to talk. There's a reason why all these things that they're talking about with Pakistan to try and have a negotiation, they actually have some terms. But let's take a look at what they are. This is what's being reported so far today. The Iranian side, their proposal, what they're talking to Pakistan about is two tracks. Number one, end the war first. Iran wants a formal declaration ending the war, an end to the U.S. naval blockade on Iranian ports, and the release of frozen Iranian assets before broader nuclear negotiations begin. In exchange, Iran would provisionally reopen the Strait of Hormuz, waive transit fees temporarily, and allow maritime traffic to resume while a new governance of regime for Hormuz is actually finalized. Iran is also on track one. Iran is also demanding a compensation mechanism funded by the U.S. and other countries involved in the attacks on Iran to pay damages inside Iran, along with the end to Israeli attacks in Lebanon. Almost all of that right there is all poison pills. This is what Iran actually wants, what they said they would be willing to end the war if all these things happen. That's just track one. And there's so many things in there. A formal declaration ending the war, and that the U.S. would have to end its blockade and then release frozen Iranian assets. And of course, for many in the United States, and you're going to see this in a second, that one pill right there is the most poison, because that's what they dogged the Obama administration for unfreezing Iranian assets. And they always characterized it as giving plane loads of cash to Iran. You didn't give them anything. You just released what was already theirs. But that's track one. Then you get down here to track two. It says nuclear negotiations after the war ends, or after the war ends. That's when we would start nuclear negotiations. Then they would suspend enrichment above 3.6 for 10 years. dilute uranium enriched above 20% under supervision inside Iran, commit not to develop a nuclear weapon, which they have. That's easy for them. It's a throwaway. That's what they've always said since 2003. Now, these are also poison pills because this says we will retain the ability to enrich. And even that will only will have a 10-year sunset, which, of course, was one of the things that the Trump administration complained so bitterly about the Obama nuclear deal, is that it had a 10-year sunset. So that's also a poison pill. And in return, Iran wants, like that wasn't bad enough, recognition of its right to enrich, limited enrichment rights preserved under a future agreement, and full sanctions relief. Other than that, it's a great deal. So that's what the Iranian side is wishing. So when I said at the top of this show here that I think that all the conditions, when you look at what's happening, it's almost the only path left. The only path left to the Trump is there are two. There's still, even with all of that, there are two. One is the one that I will continue to advocate until bombs start dropping again. That's the walk away plan. Just walk away. Claim victory, say all this damage that Trump is, loves to just rattle off all these things that have happened and things have been blown up, people killed, airplanes, ships, all that stuff. Just say, yep, and Operation Midnight Hammer, you can throw that in there as another feather in your cap. We walked away with this, we've blown it up. Take them 2 decades to reply, and if they ever do anything more, we'll come back in and bomb them again. Whatever. Say whatever you want to say. That's one possibility. The other one is the bombs away. That's it, folks. It's walk away or bombs away. There's no other option. This is why I've told you over and over again, there is no diplomatic path forward here, because you see, this is what the Iranian side is saying. I actually had a communication this morning with Professor Mirandi. Let me see if he replied to my last one here. And I asked him, I said, is Iran willing to be talking back on anything? Are they willing to be flexible anywhere? And he said Iranians are in a stronger position now than Trump. So they're in no rush to make a deal. Trump's people are showing some flexibility, but not nearly enough so far. Iran believes that if there is war, it has the upper hand. And if there's a stalemate, it can wait out longer than the U.S. Iran will not relinquish any of the 10 points that it said earlier, which is the version of what we just showed you there. It could be flexible on some issues, for example, how to collect fees at the Strait of Hormuz without having to publicize, et cetera. So he's saying, look, this is the Iranian position. What Dropside News was talking about there, that is Professor Mirandi, just minutes before we came on air here. That's what he's saying. So if that's the Iran negotiating position, let me show you what the view is from the United States side on any of those poison pills I just showed you. This is Mark Dubowitz from Foundation of Defensive Democracy. He's the very hawkish and anti-Iranian organization here in the United States. He says this proposal is a bad joke. No serious American president, especially President Trump, would accept a deal that makes the JCPOA look brilliant by comparison. The regime has never been weaker, yet its arrogance is exceeded only by its grasp of reality. One may wonder who he was talking about on that last phrase, because you talk about somebody that whose arrogance is only exceeded by its lack of grasp on reality. You might need to be looking in the mirror on that one, friend. And to his other comment there about the JCPOA, this deal would make the JCPOA look brilliant by comparison. And on that narrow point, I agree with him, because the deal we had with the JCPOA was brilliant in comparison, because it capped it out at 3.67%. It capped out how much they could reprocess, what they could do with that reprocessed material. They got rid of, I think, hundreds of pounds of the stuff that they had prior to that. They had very intensive, intrusive inspections so that we could validate all these things. And when they were found to be out of compliance, we put pressure. They came back into compliance, all those things. They declared they didn't want a nuclear weapon. It was perfect. It was brilliant. It would have prevented them from ever getting a nuclear weapon. And with even with the sunset clauses, just understand, if we had done on our part what we had promised, and the Iranian side had continued doing what it said, and through that full 10-year period of time, instead of Trump getting out in 2018, then by the time the 2025 end date had come up and the time to renegotiate, it would have been renegotiated. There is no way, it almost impossible, that Iran would have said, you know what, we're just going to get out of this deal. We're going to let these sunset clauses go off and we're going to go begin, because that would immediately, because of the provisions of the JCPOA, would have referred snapback as sanctions and everything would have been thrown on them. So all these sanctions that they would have gotten used to living without and doing commerce and having a good economy, those things would have been all thrown back at the winds and they would have destroyed everything. Ergo, they wouldn't have, because they would have had significant motivation to continue to comply with it. That's what the likes of Mark Dubowitz, Lindsey Graham, Jack Keane, Keith Kellogg, Donald Trump, none of those people ever want to admit to. In fact, Donald Trump lies flat out. There's no other word to use. I'm sorry if for those whose feelings that may hurt. When he says that was the JCPOA was a pathway to a bomb, that is absurd in the highest degree. It's a lie on face value. It would have prevented it. And now then, because we pulled out, then because of these two wars we've done in the span of less than a year, we are in a position now where the best that we could hope for is a negotiated settlement that would be a capitulation to Iran. And there's no other way to put that, too. We have to be honest. There's just no way to put it. That's what a negotiated end would look like. It would be a surrender to Iran, and that's what those terms are for. And that's why I say there's no way Trump will do that. You can't put a good face on that one. Just walking away and not agreeing to any of their terms is the only other alternative. So if he's not going to be a negotiated settlement, if he's not going to do the walkaway three, just claim success, then the only thing left is to restart combat operations. And I hope he doesn't. It's just hard for me to imagine that he would. Now, from this week also, since the best of what we learned this week, we had Colonel Doug McGregor on, who talked exactly about that issue, about how this could be resolved. And who are we even talking to?
He's trapped himself, frankly, in a very difficult position that he can attribute to his own big mouth. He's the one that said they've got to give up their enriched uranium, can't have that. They've got to open the Strait of Hormuz. Well, the Iranians have been pretty clear on that point, that they're not going to open the strait because he wants them to, and they're not going to give up their sovereignty and independence by turning over enriched uranium to the United States or anybody else. So I have great difficulty taking the whole idea seriously that we're talking to them at all. I just don't buy it. We have an 8-letter word for it in Philadelphia, but I don't want to repeat it on the air.
He never told me what that word was. So some of you from Philadelphia or have friends from Philadelphia, you may know that. Put it in the comments. Maybe you can educate us all. But he's right there. Who are we even talking to? Because we're talking to Pakistan, it appears. So there is some negotiations going on through intermediaries and maybe through Qatar and some others that I've heard, potentially, possibly even Oman. I'm not sure about that. That's true or not. Those are some of the reports there. But we're definitely talking to somebody. But how can you be talking about any serious effort to end a war when you aren't even talking to the other side? There's not even any summits on the table. There's not even any talk about it. It is self-evident that you cannot have a negotiated end unless you're negotiating with your opponent. Just sending letters and stuff back and forth to somebody saying you're almost there, you almost have a deal, is nonsense. It's just a lie for manipulating markets, but it definitely isn't going to succeed in bringing a war to an end, especially when you see what the Iranian side is. And they're aggressively talking to the Pakistanis. They would love to have that intermediary to come through and make a deal. But you see that the terms that they're on, that they're requiring, are really, really harsh. They are not backing down anywhere. And again, this is in the context that they are suffering seriously. Their people are suffering seriously. I've been reading a lot of their official news agency, ISNA, I think it's called. And they put out a lot of stuff in the Persian language to their population. It says, look, man, we got to pull together. We have to conserve everything. We've lost so much, all this. So they're really reaching out to them. There's other reports, not from their news agency, but from other regional agencies. It says their officials are cracking down hard on them and being very cruel to some of their people and pushing them hard and saying, hey, we've got to have these austerity measures because we're going to have to own this out. People are getting upset about it naturally. It's understandable. So it's not a benign issue for the Iranian side. But as Professor Mirandi told me this morning, they calculate that they can suffer that longer than we can suffer that. because President Trump can't just keep kicking this down the road because the SPRs are running out. And we're already, even with the SPRs, there's still a dearth of physical supply in the system. And you cannot have economic activity without the requisite amount of energy, oil, gas, derivatives. And then, of course, there's the food problem we haven't talked about in a little while. That is exacerbated, too. These problems compound every single day. These things are going forward. Forget about the midterms. That's now the least of President Trump's concerns. We're going to worry about whether the economy is going to start to really wobble here and maybe even go more into the recession, into a depression, because that's on the table. If we don't get this resolved, it may already be too late. We don't know. No one knows until the matters manifest and play out. But the fundamentals that are at play imply that we are in grave peril. Every day you delay makes it worse. But the worst thing is if you go back to military affairs, and you go back to the conflict, that's where you're going to be in real trouble. Well, that's not the only thing we have to worry about. I wish it was. That's big enough. But one other thing we learned about this week is that that other war that's been raging for four nearly and a half years now in Russia and Ukraine also is at risk of expansion, as Alistair Crook explained here.
The reliance on the sort of Article 5 that NATO would never be attacked by Russia because Russia would never dare to do such a thing. Relying on that to get around Russia's air defenses and to spring up right on target at St. Petersburg or Moscow. And it's now going stage by stage, and now it is getting too much. And at the same time, we've heard constantly from Europe this refrain, war, 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 prepare for war with Russia. Prepare for war, the German leadership say. We may have war even by 2027. We may have war at any moment with Russia. Even though, you know, you look around and you can see quite clearly, Europe hasn't got the capacity for war with Russia. It hasn't got the money to finance a war with Russia. It hasn't got the troops for a war with Russia. So why are they saying it? They're saying it because they hope to provoke through Ukraine and through, if you like, using these Baltic states, they are hoping to provoke Russia towards action against NATO states.
Now, when we had that show on the air, one of the things I asked him about that last part there, which was alarming, because I'm like, wait, you just painted this long picture that the Europe doesn't have the manpower, they don't have the money, they don't have the industrial capacity, they don't have the weapon stocks, they don't have the ammunition stocks, they don't have anything that's necessary to engage in a war of any nature with Russia. And yet you heard him say, but they're trying to spawn that in, they're trying to provoke Russia into doing something so that they can get a conflict. And I said, well, how can that be? That's illogical, it's irrational, and one may argue immoral. And he said, well, because they want to draw the U.S. back in, because the U.S. is, President Trump is saying, hey, we're gonna take some troops out of Germany. We might take all of them out of Germany. We might abandon NATO. I don't know what we're going to do. We may even put some troops into Poland, or we may pull some out. He's very vague on that. He keeps calling NATO a paper tiger. I want y'all to spend more money. I'm going to spend less. You know, all this stuff, distancing himself from NATO. And that's alarming many in Europe, especially the elite. And so they're saying, hey, maybe we do something like this so we can start a conflict with Russia. Then that would require America to come in, because there's no shortage of hawkish people in the United States that are lusting for that and are angry at President Trump for even talking about pulling anything out of NATO. They say, no, we need to keep this going. Those Russians are really, really good at being a boogaboo and a bear and a big bear. That's a dangerous, scary thing to keep the money flowing, especially in the military affairs, and to keep these budgets going up to 1.5 trillion and north. Because if he gets that one, military budgets never come down because the people in power just say, all right, that's probably enough. No, it only goes up unless somebody comes in and says, all right, we're going to have a reset or something like that. And that is a radical change. Nothing like that is even on the horizon. So if they want to keep that stuff going, they've got to have a good enemy. What they can't have is, all right, peace breaks out in the Middle East, peace breaks out in Europe. We don't need a $1.5 trillion defense budget. We don't need all that much money. So let's have a reset. So they can't have that. So they need to keep the wars going. That's what you need to understand here. And that's what, and please, by all means, go back and watch that full show. It's absolutely fascinating. I think we have a version of it posted on our video tab as well. Definitely worth going back and watching. But that's kind of where we are. And that is why this whole situation is so dangerous. One other thing I want to highlight that we didn't get to this week, but is also important, and it goes back again, this theme running throughout this whole episode of trust. And can you believe people? Now, it's one thing if it's politicians. Politicians, almost by their nature, are lying and stretching the truth or being deceptive or not being all the way honest and partially true, et cetera. That's kind of a normal thing that has been inherent in politicians forever, I mean, for human history. But at least in America, we're supposed to have said, but the military tells the truth. We can count on them because their integrity is unmatched. That's what it used to be. I'm going to show you two separate things here. These are a little bit longer clips than we normally have, but you're going to see why we have so. From Admiral Brad Cooper, the commander of Central Command, who came to Congress this week to testify about the conduct of the war in Iran and answer a bunch of questions there. Well, there was a couple of key things that some members of Congress asked and said, hey, first of all, we're going to look, what about those Iranian kids that got killed on day one of the war? Have we taken at least responsibility for what we did and apologized?
Thank you. Admiral Cooper, you mentioned in your opening remarks the commitment of your command to preventing civilian harm. So just two questions about that. One, it's been 80 days thereabouts since the initial bombing campaign that struck the girls' school in Iran. Tehran killed, I think, over 150 schoolgirls. It's really pretty clear what happened there. But 80 days on, we have not taken responsibility for that attack. The endless stalling that's being investigated, it's being investigated, it's being investigated. In the past, when we've had these types of mistakes, they have been quickly acknowledged, even if a further investigation is necessary to figure out prevention methods. So can you at this moment acknowledge that that mistake was made and that we were responsible for it? It's something we didn't want to do and don't want to repeat.
Congressman, to reiterate, the United States does not deliberately target
civilians. Got that part.
Period. Full stop. And nor are the Iranian people our enemy. The IRGC is the adversary in this case.
I heard that in your opening statement, Admiral. I asked you a very specific question, and I'm curious what the answer is.
So the investigation is ongoing. As soon as it is complete, I'm happy to be as
transparent
as possible.
We will not take responsibility for something we very obviously did.
And what? So it's a complex investigation. The school itself is located on an active IRGC cruise missile base.
Absolutely.
It's more complex than the average strike. As soon as we're complete, I'm fully committed to transparency, given your important oversight role and the other members here.
Just so you know, and I have an enormous amount of respect for you and an enormous amount of respect for the Pentagon, I do not trust that answer. What we've seen out of the Secretary of Defense and his callous disregard for any sort of rules of engagement or protecting civilian life may make us suspicious.
And man, the bar was so low. That member of Congress made it so easy for him to just say, yes, our evidence, our initial investigation makes it clear that we misidentified that building and that we hit it, and it was a terrible loss of life. Our hearts go out to the parents of these children, to the spouses and the other family members of the teachers that were killed. It was a terrible tragedy. And then if you want, you can throw in, you know, how dare those darn Iranians put school kids in the middle of a military target, something like that, if you wanted to. But he said, look, all he was asking for, the bar was so low. Acknowledge that mistakes have been made and give us assurances that it won't happen again. He can't even do that. He again starts saying all this stuff about it. We never target civilians. Didn't ask you that. That's not anything that we do. That's not what we're all about. I got it. That's not what I'm asking about. Rules of engagement, whatever. I want to know, are we at least willing to acknowledge responsibility? And he would not do it. Now, if somebody had been at war with us, if Iran had been at war with us, and let's say on one of these military bases that they have hit of ours, if instead of hitting a $1 billion radar, for example, that they misidentified something and instead hit a dependent school and killed a bunch of American kids, are we going to accept hey, you know, it's war. Sometimes mistakes happen. It's bad, but it is war. We did have it on a military base. We do that, by the way. We had, I don't know if in these particular ones, but I know in many of my bases that I was deployed in overseas, there were schools. And we, so we had places for kids, daycares even, and they were on a base. So it's always been conceivable that someone can either do it on purpose or misidentify a building or something and hit it. Are we ever, and I mean ever, under any circumstances, you name it, are we going to say, well, it's regrettable that our children were killed by the enemy, but it is war after all. But as soon as they do a thorough investigation and very far into the future, when they explain to us what happened, then we'll say, well, it's regrettable. I mean, we would not wait 1 hour, friend, not 1 hour. We would be immediately launching something back at somebody, and we would be building this whole public publicity campaign about demonizing the other side and saying how evil, how wicked they are, and they all deserve to be destroyed. There is no justification. There is no explanation they could give. That's what we would say. And now that we have done it, we can't even cross a bar that's basically on the ground by saying, yes, it was a terrible mistake. We have never issued any kind of condolences to the family. Nothing like that. I saw that in Afghanistan. When there was a number of times when there was some legitimate mistakes that were made, and we did kill civilians, and we took responsibility for it. Then we made public announcements for it. In some cases, we sent admirals to villages where people were killed that were not supposed to be, that we thought were Taliban that weren't. We did that back then, but under the current leadership, we admit nothing and do everything. Now, if that had been the only soundbite I showed you from that exchange, that would have been bad enough. Unfortunately, it got a little bit worse.
Do you think it's ever appropriate for anybody in a leadership position to use the words no quarter when describing how we are conducting our operations in Iran?
So I think it's appropriate as military leaders. We follow the law of armed conflict and our constitutional responsibilities, and that's what we've done.
And you would agree that no quarter is not following the law?
I would agree it's our constitutional responsibility to follow the law.
Is no quarter following the law or not?
I would agree that we follow the law, sir.
Generic understanding of it, and then do whatever we want to do with no accountability. Look, people make mistakes. It's in a war. Things happen. I get that, okay? And I'm not going to be as overly judgmental as some. But that the arrogance of this Pentagon and their unwillingness to acknowledge any mistake is precisely the reason that we are in the hole that we're in with no way out of. Somebody in that command needs to own up to the dumb things that are said and done to give us some confidence that they won't keep happening.
Again, the bar was so low. Just tell me no quarter is against American law, against American military law, against international law of warfare. Just acknowledge that it is and that we're not going to do it. That's all he had to say. But instead, he just kept going, we will follow the law. Okay. And will you follow the law on this? We will follow the law. Okay. Is this saying no quarter following the law? All you got to say is no. But see, he can't. And let me tell you why he can't. Because he's a coward. No other way to put it. There's a lot worse ways I could put it, but there's no way more accurate. He is afraid of Pete Hegseth and is afraid of President Trump. And he knows, Admiral Cooper knows that if he said yes to that question and answered it honestly with integrity and said, yes, a charge of no quarter violates American law and we're not going to follow it. He knows that the second he gets up out of that chair, his phone's going to be ringing. It's going to be Pete Hegseth on the line, ripping him a new one. As soon as he gets back to the Pentagon, he'll have a face-to-face. He could be fired that later afternoon. He knows all that. And he is not willing to do the right thing on something so easy and such a low bar as to just acknowledge what American law is and that he's committed to honor it and that he's not going to violate it. Instead, he lies a second time by saying, we will follow the laws of war, when he won't. He won't even call out what the law is. And he will not give them assurances that we're not going to do that. And of course, Secretary Hegseth won't either. We've shown you that soundbite on our show in the past where he said that. no mercy, no quarter. He even says it in prayers sometimes. It's just bizarre and perverted as it gets. That's who is leading our country right now. And of course, that's protected by President Trump. So that is the state of play right now. There is no morality among our senior leaders. There's no integrity, and there's no honor, and there's no honesty even with the American people, with anybody else. I only in the future, after all this is over, and people are going to go back and be able to do, you know, in interviews with hundreds of people that were involved with all this, only then will we know the full scope of what's going on. I don't know. I have a few sources that have access to the White House and the government at various places, but they're not that big, just being honest. They're not that many anyway. So there's a lot that I don't know about what's going on. But what we do know, with no sources needed, is that what we see in public is that there is a gross shift in what used to be the character and honor and morality of the United States, at least an aspiration. I'm not naive to think that that was ever actually the case all across the board, but many of us, and I was in there, so I know that there were many in uniform that genuinely aspired and tried and sought and acted to embody those things and make them real. Integrity, being honest, open to power, challenging power, but being honest about what we're doing and seeking to do the right thing, limiting our power. I saw it in combat, so I know for a fact that it was at least a portion of the fabric of our country. It has been. And I know that it still is, because we have some contacts and some of my friends have contacts with our troops now, and there are still many, I would say a significant majority of them, are still that way and are in anguish about what they see among our senior leaders here. But there are too many others in our public writ large that are cheering this stuff on, and they're fine with no quarter given. I've shown you that compilation before, and after we illegally overtook the leader of Venezuela and stole their oil, and they're bragging about it. There's no law, international law. It's just the law of the jungle, and we're the lion, and they all bragged about it. Those are politicians. Those are supporters. So that's a problem that's going to be harder to overcome. But we have to be open about what the nature of the problem is right now. Let me just tell you one thing as we close here today. This is not just an academic process here. This is not just we shouldn't be that way. We should be this way. There are consequences to being this way. When no one trusts you, no one will listen to you, everyone on the other side will do whatever they can to harm you that otherwise wouldn't, because of fear that you have no morals, you have no foundation, you have no values except for power. And you will exploit everyone if you get the chance, which means now then they will start to do the same to undercut that, to limit the power to even self-defense. That's where we are. And especially at this moment here, I fear, we're making this on Saturday morning, I fear that by the time I get back to my studio and back to my home base on Sunday night, I wonder, will we be back at hot war again? A lot of signs indicate that. A lot of evidence suggests that we will. And as I pointed out at the opening of the show, there's only really three paths that are theoretically possible: negotiated settlement, the walk away, or the bombs away. Forget diplomacy, because we're not having any. We're not actually engaging any. So it's either walk away or bombs away. And walk away seems to be the least likely now. Guess what that leaves? That's what I fear. I don't know how Trump gets out of this without doing the bombs away. I look forward to seeing you Monday morning back from my studio in Washington, D.C. See you then.